everyone. I'm Gary Naugh, and you're listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Each week, we take this time to address an issue that is not getting what I consider objective and fair coverage within the mainstream or alternative medias. Today, we're going to isolate one part of a very important major puzzle, and that is what really happened at 9/11. Any reasonable and responsible person looking at the facts and the official report would come to the same conclusion that over 2,000 scientists and people with strong backgrounds and critical thinking have come to, that there are glaring errors in this report. It could not have happened the way they were, the official report said. There had to be another backstory. We believe it's important, rather than to projecting what happened, unless we have hard proof, instead show what did not happen or did not happen as we were told, and therefore know that there is a larger agenda here. There's another story. On my program right now is Susan Lindauer. Susan is a former U.S. intelligence asset who covered anti-terrorism at the Iraqi embassy in New York from 1996 until the invasion. Independent sources have confirmed that she gave advance warning about the 9/11 attack. She also started talks for the Lockerbie trial with Libyan diplomats. Shortly after requesting to testify before Congress about successful elements of pre-war intelligence, she became the first non-Arab American arrested on the Patriot Act as an Iraqi agent. She was accused of warning her second cousin, White House Chief of Staff Andrew Card, and Secretary of State Colin Powell, that war with Iraq would have catastrophic consequences. She was right. She was subjected to 1 year in prison on Carswell Air Force Base in Fort Worth, Texas, without trial or hearing. After 5 years of indictment without conviction or guilt plea, the Justice Department dismissed all charges 5 days before President Obama's inauguration. She is the author of Extreme Prejudice, The Terrifying Story of the Patriot Act and the Cover-Up Acts of 9/11 and Iraq. Nice to have you with us today, Susan.
I'm so delighted to be on your show again, Gary.
Susan, what I'm going to do is I'm going to lay out a few points and ask you to take your time and to create a story. There is no rushing. There's no commercials. So you do not have to give us a short answer. We need to connect the dots. It is this context of an answer that allows us to see the legitimacy within your argument. All right?
Thank you. Thank you.
Now, that said, and that's why I don't have anyone else here except you. Here's what
I am honored by that because I was listening to your guests before the segment, and my story illustrates what they were talking about, the corporate media failing the people and deliberately obfuscating national security issues on the phony premise that they're protecting the government, and by protecting the government they're protecting us from our own selves. And my story proves what a lie, what balderdash that really is.
All right, that said, there's going to be three stories that you're going to share with us. The first story is what you found out about 9/11 prior to it occurring, and then who you reached out to and what was the response. That is the first story, so that's going to be in depth. Then I want you to talk about what you have learned about the actual Lockerbie bombing, the plane, because I'm fully aware of an investigative report that shows that it had nothing to do with the Libyans, but I'd like for, in the forensic evidence that was presented and the hard evidence and what really happened and what you know that could give us a completely different perspective. And last, and very important, is when you spoke and gave this information to Secretary of State Colin Powell and to the White House Chief of Staff, the third most powerful person in that White House, Andrew Card, who was your related, your second cousin, what did they do with that? And why didn't they come to your defense? I would have thought that Colin Powell would have at least had the integrity, if he knew of your arrest and knew of your imprisonment or charges, or someone would have come to help you. And then through that, you're going to talk about what it meant to be found worthy of arrest and imprisonment under the Patriot Act, and how a lot of people don't realize that Patriot Act has actually been strengthened, and it is worse than what it originally was with the second Patriot Act. So there's the form that you have. These are the stories. Keep each story separate so we can see how they all connect. The form is yours. Take your time.
Absolutely. Gary, thank you so much. A lot of Americans are still surprised to discover that 9/11 was a total fraud. When we talk about an inside job, there are different definitions of what the government might have done, but this is factually what happened prior to 9/11. So I will allow, you know, your listeners can draw their own conclusions about what type of explosives were used and all of that, but I want to draw out what happened before the attack, because this is very important. Any police officer will tell you that a crime requires motive and opportunity. And the reason that I was ultimately arrested on the Patriot Act was the government was desperately trying to hide the fact that we knew about 9/11 for months prior to the event. And the Bush administration had already decided that if there was any possible way, they intended to blame Saddam Hussein's government and push the United States into war using 9/11 as the justification. I first learned about the 9/11, the threat of hijackings and a strike on the World Trade Center from my own CIA handler, Dr. Richard Fuse, in April of 2001. And I was, he called me up at home and he said, we met weekly anyway, and we spoke on the phone every single day. But at that time, I was the back channel for the CIA and the Defense Intelligence Agency to the Iraqi embassy and the Libya house. I had already done the Lockerbie negotiations with Libya. I was already in the middle of preliminary talks on resuming the weapons inspections. And we had a whole peace option that was being hammered out very successfully. Everything the United States wanted, Baghdad was agreeing to, including allowing the FBI to send a terrorism task force into Baghdad with authorization to conduct investigations, interrogate witnesses, and make arrests. Okay, so forget the story that Saddam was connected to terrorism. Saddam deeply feared religious fundamentalists and in the Arab world. He was afraid that they were going to destabilize his country and push for his overthrow, and that they would that the Islamic radicalism would be attractive to the very poor Iraqi people under sanctions. So he gave us as much help as he ever could trying to protect his own government, okay, and he recognized that Iraq was a very strong bulwark against Iran. So throughout this whole year before 9/11, Iraq was trying very hard to establish its worthiness to be an ally of the United States in combating Islamic fundamentalists specifically, and to stand against Iran. So in April of 2001, my CIA handler summoned me to his office, and he said he had a very important message that he had to get to Baghdad right away, and he wanted me to go up to New York and deliver it. And since that was my job, that was my role, I ran over to his office, and he said, "Susan, we want you to tell the Iraqis that we are looking for any intelligence involving airline hijackings and or airline bombings, and we think there's going to be an attack using airplanes against the World Trade Center." This is April of 2001. And he said to me, I want you to tell the Iraqis that we are looking, we want them to send a message to Baghdad, and if they, and we're asking them to give us any information about this attack that they've got, this conspiracy, and if they don't give it, if they don't give it to us, and if the attack happens and we find out that they held back, then we're gonna bomb them. We're gonna attack them. So I went up to New York, and I was, at the first time, I was very polite. I had no reason at that point to be rude, because Saddam had always been helpful. Saddam had always given us everything that we wanted. And so when I fully expected, I knew that the Iraqi government would be very cooperative, would, you know, they would handle it the way that they always did, and if we wanted it and if they had it, they'd give it to us. I wasn't worried about that at all. So I went up to New York and I had a conversation, and sure enough, the diplomat promised to send me, to send the message on to get the cable back to Baghdad. And I went back to Richard Fuse and he said, so what happened when you threatened the Iraqis? And I said, oh, I didn't threaten the Iraqis. I just gave them the message, and I expect that they're going to do what we said, what we asked, and no problem. And he said, I didn't tell you to be nice to those blankety, blankety, blankety's. I cannot say the words on the radio. They were very obscene words, and the FCC would be on you. They were very nasty words. Sand nigger was part of it. But there were a lot of other four-letter words on top of that. He said, I told you to tell those blankety, 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 blankety's that we're going to go to war with them. We're going to smash them harder than they've ever been bombed before. We're going to bomb them into the Stone Age. Now realize that at this point we had hit Baghdad so hard, so many times, that it was impossible for anyone to conceive of anything worse than what we'd already done. And he wanted me to communicate that this was something that they had not, they could not anticipate. They had never endured anything like we were going to do to them if they didn't give us this intelligence. So I went back to him, to the Iraqis, and one more thing, very important detail. I was chagrined. I was like Richard. I was stunned. I was like, you know, oh my goodness, you know. This is a real attack. This is not just checking the trap lines. This is a real threat. And he's like, yes. Yes, it is. And he told me something else. He said, I want you to tell the Iraqi government this threat, which is now the end of April 2001, this threat originates at the highest levels of government, above the CIA director, and above the Secretary of State. And that was the exact wording that I was told to use. Now, there are only three people who are covered by that. It is the President of the United States, George Bush, the Vice President of the United States, Dick Cheney, and Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, and no others, nobody else. And so that was the message. The CIA director knew, the Secretary of State Colin Powell knew about it, CIA Director George Tenet knew about it, but the threat originated above them. And it was not an arbitrary, you know, warning. This was something that, you know, I was reprimanded, heavily reprimanded, for not delivering the message the way that I was supposed to. He reminded me, which surprised me, that I was a back channel and I was supposed to say whatever they said. I was not supposed to put it in my words. I was supposed to use their words. And this had been careful. This message had been had been vetted, and this was the message. And they wanted it to go up there. And they were looking for any intelligence on airplane hijackings and a strike on the World Trade Center. Okay, now that's with a threat of war attached.
Now, if they knew that there was going to be an attack on the World Trade Center, what was it that they didn't know that they were asking you to try to get from the Iraqis? And were they of the opinion that the Iraqis were part of that attack?
Ah, now this is where it gets interesting. What my CIA handler told me was that they wanted actionable intelligence. That's nuts and bolts intelligence. Who, what, when, where. And so, you know, I get specific details that would help them piece together the conspiracy. Now, this was where it got very interesting because I, of course, went up to the Iraqis and I said, you know, we really want this intelligence. And Baghdad's response was, well, if you think there's a conspiracy in play, why don't you send the FBI into Iraq? And if you think there's something here that we have not found, you have our permission to come get it. If you think there's somebody here that we don't know about and you know about them, come into our country and get it. That was their response in May of 2001 and June and July. In August, they threw up their hands and said, you know more, you the CIA, you the American government, know more about this attack than anybody. All of the chattering about this 9/11 conspiracy, about this airplane hijacking conspiracy, all of it comes back to you. Every time we hear about it, it's in relationship to what you are saying. But it's not what anybody else is saying. It's what you are the source of the rumors. Isn't that something? You, the American government, are the source of the rumors about the terrorist strike involving the airplane hijacking from the strike on the World Trade Center. And Saddam had the best sources. He had deep connections all through the Middle East, and he prided himself on tracking Islamic fundamentalists and jihadis and knowing what they were going to do. And we were in the middle of the peace, of this wonderful peace option. It involved weapons inspections, cooperation with anti-terrorism, contracts for American corporations in healthcare, hospital equipment, pharmaceuticals, transportation. They were going to buy, if you're anywhere in Ohio or the Midwest, think of this, 1 million American-manufactured automobiles every year for 10 years. And that would have been jobs in the Rust Belt. That would have been jobs in Michigan and Ohio and Indiana. That would have been auto parts supplies. It would have been everything for us. The CIA was determined to strike a very hard bargain with Saddam to create a peace bonanza for the United States economy such that we would benefit from the lifting of this. Whenever the sanctions were lifted at the end of the weapons inspections, American corporations would be able to profit and have income and jobs for workers, profits on Wall Street. The CIA was ruthless, frankly, because, for all of you who know, the sanctions had already killed about 2 million human beings, 1.7 million Iraqis, up to possibly 2.2 million had died from sanctions. And here we were saying, we want the sun and the moon and the stars. And Saddam said yes. So this thing with this airplane hijacking, he was like, well, if we hear anything, yeah, well, the diplomats were like, of course we want to give it to you. Absolutely, this is not a problem. If we know of anything, but we don't. You are the only ones tracking this. You are the source.
Okay, we got that part of the story, Susan. Let's go forward now.
Okay.
So now you have multiple meetings, back channel meetings. You're speaking on behalf of the CIA, the White House, the President, the Secretary of Defense, and Vice President. So you are the number one liaison. And you're coming up with nothing, but
the Iraqis have nothing to give us throughout the whole summer.
But clearly, for over 6 months, the United States government knew that there was going to be a bombing, and they knew that there was going to be planes, and they knew it was going to be the World Trade Organization or trade headquarters. So we had never been told that. Now take us forward from there.
Yes. Throughout the summer, practically every meeting with my CIA handler, June and July, every weekly meeting talked about this threat and how the CIA was sweating bullets for it. Richard was convinced the attack was going to happen at the end of the summer, early fall.
What did he relate to you? What information can you tell us that you can remember that would have given us an idea that he actually knew of a credible threat?
Well, here's the thing. Later on, this was corroborated by an independent witness, Park Godfrey, a professor of computer science, as it happens, at York University in Toronto, Canada. He was a very good friend of mine in Maryland in the year 2001, and he was job hunting, and he says that he remembers vividly my telling him over and over again throughout the summer that he must stay out of New York, that we expected an airplane hijacking strike on the World Trade Center specifically, and that we expected it to be a reprise of the 93 World Trade Center attack, and that it would finish the cycle that was started. And he said that I was very clear that the attack would occur at the end of the summer and early September or early fall. And that in August, he testified in federal court in Manhattan, 1,000 feet from where the World Trade Center once stood. He testified that I told him in August that the attack was imminent, and that I warned him and his family, his parents, who live in the suburbs in Connecticut, that I warned them to stay out of New York City because we expected mass casualties and a possible miniature thermonuclear device to be used in conjunction with the airplane hijackings. And so this is where, at this point, I have to tell everybody, explain to everybody, that I am convinced that 9/11 was what we call a cover and deception operation. Okay, cover and deception means that they use the airplane hijackings as some like a magician's trick, where your eyes are on the left hand, and you see the left hand, you see the airplanes flying over the water and striking the World Trade Center, and your eyes make the connection that those airplanes are causing the result, which is that the towers collapse. But in fact, it's a magician's trick. It's a deception. They know that they can fool you with that, but the real cause of the towers coming down was the demolition, because they had planted explosives into the buildings. During the summer of 2001, June, July, approximately July, My defense intelligence handler and I had conversations over where they were going to get the nuclear bomb, because we did think it would be nuclear. I know that Richard Gage thinks of it as being nanothermite. There's strong evidence that he is correct. There is some evidence that there might have been nuclear weapons. There's nuclear contamination, nuclear particles. But the real evidence is nanothermite, and I'm willing to give him that. I don't want to take away from Richard Gage's research.
But take us forward.
Okay.
So nobody paid attention to you.
So what happened? So the next thing was that in August. So anyway, we were talking about where the bombs would come from, and how it would be very easy to steal the bombs from any military facility. That a truck, I remember vividly my defense intelligence handler telling me that a truck could drive off a base and carry away the weapons, and they would just like falling off a truck. Like when the mafia used to, you know, fall, the merchandise would fall off the truck for the mafia.
I'm giving you the whole hour, but I'm afraid if we get caught up too much in the minutia or repetition, you're not going to have a chance to tell your story. Now, I want you to tell your story.
Okay,
so
I'm sorry.
And go forward.
Okay, what is important to know is that in August of 2001, I was asked by my CIA handler to telephone the office of Attorney General John Ashcroft and to ask for an emergency broadcast alert across all federal agencies for any fragment of intelligence that they might be able to contribute regarding the airplane hijackings and the strike on the World Trade Center identified specifically, and warning that it was an imminent attack. It should be considered the highest emergency priority for action, and that they should respond to all agencies. So in the middle, that was about August 8th. On approximately August 16th or 17th, the FBI in Minneapolis responded with information about the arrest of Mosawi, and they asked John Ashcroft's office if they could open his computer to get information about whether he was contributing to a conspiracy involving airplane hijackings. What the public was never told was that we had originated, that request for the emergency broadcast alert had originated in Washington, and the FBI in Minneapolis, was responding to a request for information. And so that's something that's been hidden from the public, and I think it would have changed everything if the people had been allowed to know the full extent of the worrying and fear that had built up in the intelligence community over the summer. George Bush, on August 6th, had received a presidential briefing memo, and he apparently looked at it and said, oh, now you've covered your butt. Let's go play some golf. Go shoot some golf balls. Well, when I called John Ashcroft's office, I had been working in anti-terrorism for a decade at that point, and I had phone numbers inside his private office. And it's worth noting that the person that I was speaking to on the phone could look across the room and see John Ashcroft, who was his immediate boss. And so this was not going into the ether of the Justice Department. This was not some 800 number on the highway. If you see a terrorist suspicious activity, call this 800 number. No. This went to John Ashcroft's private staff. And at their instruction, I called the Office of Counterterrorism and repeated the message to them as well. So what happens is you have a whole bunch of people at the Justice Department and the CIA and the NSA who all have this information about this attack. And then this becomes a hellacious cover-up in George Bush's desperation to hold on to power, and the Republican leadership's desire to hold on to power. They obliterated the truth. There's serious question as to whether that's treason. If you have allowed people to die, Susan.
Those of you who just joined us, we're halfway through our program. We're looking at the unheeded warning signs about 9/11 and a look at the terrors behind the Patriot Act with Susan Lindauer, a former U.S. intelligence asset. And Susan, now we had the bombing, or we had the terror attack. What happened then? And give us a rather stepped up sequence of events.
Okay. After 9/11, I was, of course, the designated person to get Iraq's cooperation with the 9/11 investigation. Iraq's response was, why did you let these people die? You had more information than anybody. You've been talking about this for months. Why did you not stop the attack? Why didn't you do something? You know, you're coming back to us and you're blaming us. But you did this. You had to know. You knew more than anybody else. And so they were very scornful. They were scathing in their criticism of the United States. But then when they calmed down, Iraq immediately responded that they would renew the offer for the FBI to send a task force into Iraq, and that they would welcome all cooperation, just like Pakistan was doing, just like Libya was doing, and some of these, you know, these other countries that were considered pariah nations. Iraq was very quick to want to participate and to contribute positively. And they offered us financial documents on Al-Qaeda, early Al-Qaeda figures, They offered to show a Middle Eastern link to the Oklahoma City bombing conspiracy, showing that Terry Nichols and Timothy McVeigh had received financial assistance and technical assistance from the culprits of the 1993 World Trade Center attack, Sheikh Abdurrahman and Ramzi Youssef, and that, in fact, Ramzi Youssef, we do know, it appears, had a meeting with Terry Nichols in the Philippines, which was also a radical hotbed of Islamic fundamentalism at the time. And so the Iraqis tried to be very proactive and to contribute something very solid. The financial documents from Iraq would have allowed the United States, would have dramatically helped the United States step up seizures of terrorism dollars. We could have shut down the financial pipeline, seriously crippled it, so that we didn't need to go into war with Afghanistan. We could have taken all their money. We didn't need to go to war anywhere. We would have had a much more dramatic effectiveness if we had just shut down, if we just took away all their cash and found all their hiding places and removed it. Done. It's over. You know, but that's not what they wanted. They did not want to have any peace. And so, meanwhile, the Iraqis, you know, after 9/11, the Iraqis stepped up their support for the peace option and were pushing very, very, very hard for the peace option to go forward. That is, the weapons inspections, cooperation on anti-terrorism, contracts for American corporations, oil contracts. We could have had as much oil as we wanted. We never had to go to war for any of this. Saddam even offered, and this shocked some people, offered he said he wanted to retire, and that there would be, he invited the Iraqi exiles to return and live in expanded embassy domiciles. Embassies are sovereign territory of the home country. And he said that they would be protected by embassy security. They would have free movement all over the country. They could set up newspapers, have opposition party headquarters, and have a real race, a real election. And he said, Jimmy Carter is welcome to come and monitor this election. And he said that he might not even be there because he really wanted to retire. And he said he did not ask, he did not demand $1 billion in order to retire. He was just going to go off into the country. And he was an old man, and he was done. He was finished. And they okay. knew it. Everybody knew this. The CIA knew it. The White House knew it.
Then take us to the next step.
And the next step is the United States goes to war with Iraq. And the war is blamed on Saddam's alleged support for Al Qaeda, which is nonsense. The war is the only way to solve these problems. That there's no options except for violence. And of course the whole world, you know, beseeched George Bush not to do it. But the greed, it was greed for the military-industrial complex. They wanted war bombs, military contracts. They had no concern for American soldiers. They did not think about the consequences for the United States in the region or the financial costs or the health costs for the soldiers or anything. All they cared about was Halliburton and, and making sure that they could take away oil contracts that had been given to European and Russian company oil corporations, and that everything would be shifted over to the United States. So instead of having a world bonanza after a worldwide bonanza after the Iraqi sanctions, it would all be channeled into the United States. Well, we of course have seen what that did. And now I'll tell you the third part is of the story, which is what they decided they had to do to me. The reason that you don't know any of this the people don't, the American people don't know what really happened. You were all told that my intelligence had been very poor, lousy, bad assets, crappy. We'd done a terrible job. It was our fault. We misled the government. The poor members of Congress were deceived by our silence in the run-up to the war. Nobody tried to correct the mistakes and their assumptions on Capitol Hill. Well, that was totally nonsense. I had been a very aggressively part of the peace movement, anti-war movement. I was very outspoken. I had pounded Congress in the House and Senate with opposition papers, education papers, describing the consequences of the war. Colin Powell was the next-door neighbor of my CIA handler, and I delivered information to him prior to his big speech at the United Nations. You know, he has always said that, you know, that the mid-level people at CIA failed badly, really let him down, because nobody came to him and warned him that his intelligence on the weapons of mass destruction was unreliable, that the exiles lied, that he should never have trusted what they were saying to him. Well, there was just this problem. I did it. I did all of that. And when they decided to rewrite the history books and to lie to the American people, I was the first sacrifice on the altar. I had requested to testify on Capitol Hill, which was the proper procedure. Now, unfortunately, I wish to God the above that I had had a Julian Assange. If I had had a Julian Assange, I would have made sure the public knew before the war about the peace option. But I did not have a Julian Assange. The whole world would have been better if you'd known about the choices that the government was looking at. But I was completely alone, and I was not, you know, I was schooled in secrecy, and I was not gifted at dealing with the blogs and internet radio at that stage. That's not something I knew how to do. And right. At this point, this was, you know, 2004. The internet was very young at that stage.
Susan, we only have 15 minutes. So I need you. Now I'm going to direct the rest of this. So I'm going to need you to give us short answers to my questions, all right?
Okay, sorry.
You volunteered to testify before Congress, yes?
Yes.
Okay, what happened with that testimony or effort?
30 days after I requested to testify, I woke to hear the FBI pounding on my front door with an arrest warrant, and I was arrested on the Patriot Act. I was the second non-Arab American arrested on the Patriot Act, subjected to secret charges.
Were you tortured?
I was locked up in prison on Carswell Air Force Base. I was held for I was under indictment for 5 years with no trial. I was held, when I was locked up in prison, the government declared that I was not competent to stand trial, and they requested permission to forcibly drug me with Haldol, Ativan, and Prozac. And for all of you who are fortunate enough not to know what Haldol is, that's a chemical lobotomy. Haldol imitates the effects of Parkinson's disease, so that it has the effect of making you like a statue. You cannot walk or speak. You cannot write. You cannot read. You cannot process information. You are essentially a drooling statue, and you can't wash, bathe yourself. It's a horrible, horrible drug, and it's reserved in prisons for what it's supposed to be reserved in prisons for the most violent offenders who are dangerous to other inmates and to guards. And in fact, what they're doing in Carswell Air Force Base is they're socking it to women who are, most of them are middle class black, to be honest with you. There one woman who was fighting this, who tried very hard to stop it, was a piano teacher who taught Mozart, Chopin, Tchaikovsky, Wagner, And they had asked her if she taught white, she was a black woman, and they said, do you teach white children? She said, well, of course, yes. And you teach a black woman teaching white children classical music. And they're like, well, you don't teach them in your home, do you? You go to, because you're like, a black person is still a servant. So you go to their home, right?
Okay, Susan,
said, no, I have
Susan,
my
Susan,
sorry.
You're diverting. Stay on point.
Okay. You right. asked if I was tortured. I had to fight it off.
Okay.
I fought it off.
All right. It was very, very ugly. Did you have an attorney?
I had a public defender who had sold me it down the river. We didn't. It was only after my case was dismissed that I found out that there had been a secret debriefing at the Justice Department 3 weeks before I was declared incompetent to stand trial. And even after that attorney, that public attorney, was replaced by a superior private attorney, we had no idea that he had cut a deal against me. When I was locked up in prison, he threw up his hands and took no action to have me released. My uncle, who is a wonderful attorney himself, came out and tried to help with my case, and he was blocked by the military base from entering the prison to have meetings with me. This is very scary, reminiscent of the NDAA law. My uncle, who is an attorney, was told that there was no prison on the base. And then after that, he was told that there was a prison, but it had no visiting hours, so he couldn't come in to see me. And the whole time, other people were there at the same time he was. Other families were going around him to visit their inmate family members. And so this is what's going to happen with the NDAA.
Okay, hold on. Stay on point. All right. Because we don't have a lot of time. We only
sure.
have 12 minutes.
Okay.
I want to get the rest of this out. Now,
sure.
Why do you believe that all charges were dismissed against you 5 days before President Obama's inauguration?
I was locked up in prison for a year. And when I was released, ordinarily the charges would have been dropped immediately. However, the government wanted to silence me through the Obama-McCain election. And what they found was that after I was in prison, I was no longer so passive about speaking. And my reputation was destroyed, so because I was accused of being, you know, a religious maniac and incompetent, and people thought that I might be a nutcase. And it was just ridiculous. It was absurd accusations that had no substantiation. But good internet radio, the corporate media had totally destroyed my reputation, but internet radio began to give me a forum. And they began to ask some very good questions as to what exactly the government was trying to hide. And so all through the presidential election of John McCain and Obama, the government, the Justice Department, repeatedly tried to take me back into custody. At one point, I was forced to go into court with no attorney present to fight a bail revocation. They made up stories about me that they tried to use to justify having my bail revoked. The attacks on me only stopped after the November ballot. And once Obama won, overnight, they didn't want my case anymore. And at that point, the prosecutor called my new attorney, who was the second attorney, the great Brian Shaughnessy, and they said, look, we just want this case to go away. You don't think she's going to write a book, do you? I was like, oh, yes, I am. But my attorney said, just don't say that to them. Let the case go away.
Susan,
and so 5 days before the inauguration, they dropped the charges.
Okay. Now you're out of prison. You knew the truth that there was, you knew that the president, vice president, secretary of defense at least knew that there was going to be a bombing, and at least 6 months in advance. You knew that it had nothing to do with Iraq and Saddam Hussein. And now, you go to testify before Congress, and immediately the FBI arrest you, and they keep you in effect, solitary confinement. and they compromise your legal help. Then you get out. Now that you're out, what have you learned since that have given you a different perspective on why they were so threatened by you and the information you had?
Why were they? Well, the truth is a terrifying thing to these people. They have the entire premise of the war on terrorism has been a major fraud. It is about profit. It is straight profit motivation.
Okay, but that's not what I'm asking. I'm not asking a philosophical or existential question. I'm asking a very practical question. You were the only person who, at the time, was a CIA U.S. intelligence asset that knew that there was prior knowledge throughout the White House, throughout
the CIA. Oh, I think that many people knew. I think many people knew. I'm just the only one who's talking about it.
Okay.
Because no one else, it's like a big secret. George Tenet has now said that there were 105 debriefings of the memos to the White House, 105 memos to the White House describing the Al-Qaeda threat in the summer of 2001. And Richard Clark has now said that, you know, that there was they've now gone on record about the presidential briefing memo on August 6th. What the government did was treason. And these top officials, it's more than just negligence. I have learned since then, for example, that what I did not know until after my book was released, and it was too late to put into the book, for example, that that from about August 23rd until September 3rd, vans were seen arriving at the World Trade Center at about 3 o'clock in the morning after the janitorial trucks had left the building. And every night from about 3 a.m. till about 5 a.m., the trucks would leave again, and there was some strange nightly activity that was going on there. And it's been speculated that they could have been taking out the gold that was in the World Trade Center and removing it for safekeeping because they knew the building was going to be attacked and they wanted to save it. The other thing is that they were probably planting the last of the explosives that were necessary before the attack occurred. And all of this was captured on the parking garage tapes, the videotapes. And those types of things would have been a smoking gun. It proved that there was the possibility that the building was wired. It definitely proves that. And so it supports my belief that the airplane hijackings were a cover and deception operation for the controlled demolition of the building using some weapons that I will leave it to Richard Gage and the others to decide what kinds of weapons those were. That needs to be a scientific study, and I'm not qualified. You know, there has been research that shows it was nanothermite, and I'm prepared to accept that. I had been told that we expected a miniature thermonuclear device. That doesn't mean that that's exactly what they used, but we always were told the airplane hijackings would occur in tandem with an explosion, that both would happen, and that the towers, we expected the towers to collapse. We expected mass casualties. And the whole thing was to create a profit center for the military-industrial complex, so that they could you know, bilk U.S. taxpayers exponentially forever, endlessly forever.
Okay.
And
several of your statements here must be put into a proper context. The fact that there is some evidence of unusual activity by white vans there does not in and of itself prove causality that they went in there and put thermitic detonation devices throughout the towers.
That's correct.
It's speculative. It is also speculative that the people who were preventing your information from being disseminated were complicit in this. It may seem like it, but we don't have the hard evidence. All we know is that there were more than 160 witnesses, including first responders, fire chiefs, and engine company heads, and police, and from all different areas, who heard explosions seconds before the actual plane hit. In fact, we've actually interviewed the person, Mr. Gonzalez, who was thrown about 8 feet against the wall in the basement where the explosion occurred in the room behind him, or in front of him, and he had to carry out a guy prior to the plane hitting, prior.
Yes.
So this is factual. This is not speculative. What we don't know is we can only speculate. And here is the final minute or two on speculation. This is purely a hypothesis. But knowing in advance from your information as a whistleblower, working within the CIA's and U.S. intelligence asset family, that many individuals at the highest forms of highest levels of government knew that the attack was going to occur, which buildings would be attacked and how, by plane, mm-hmm. not to have caused all of the different people at the World Trade Center to have been evacuated in advance, and not to have put their assets in stopping it, because if they knew it was going to occur, then they knew and how it was going to occur, then they would have known when it was going to occur and who was involved in it. They would have had infiltrated it.
It was very easy to stop the attack. All they had to do was put a single anti-aircraft battery on top of the World Trade Center, and they could have shot down any plane approaching the towers.
Okay, but again, you're don't start with the assumption that they wanted to prevent this. If they
if they could have prevented it very easily.
I'm not saying they couldn't have prevented it, Susan. I'm saying we can't start with the assumption that they wanted to prevent it. If they had, simple logic and reason suggest that if someone knew that there was an attack by people who were grossly incompetent, attached to Al-Qaeda and financed out of Saudi Arabia. You have to remember that the majority of those people came from and were financed through Saudi Arabia. That if it served a larger purpose of being able to put the neocons in a better position to affect policy and body politic and economic advantage in the Middle East, then they could have then hypothetically allowed, not only allowed to go forward, but make sure that it wasn't just an accident, but a horrific accident by detonating the buildings. And having detonated the buildings, now they're faced with two things. They're faced with 2,000 experts who all have looked at the evidence and saying it didn't happen this way.
Yeah.
We don't know what happened, but we know it didn't. Now, on tomorrow's program, we're going to be talking with a whole group of panelists who will tell us that how did a 10-foot circular hole in the Pentagon happen when the windows above that hole and to the sides are not crushed with a 44-foot wing, a tail of the plane that went through there, nor the wingspan showing any indentation into the building. You would have had, in effect, a blueprint, an outline of where the plane hit. It doesn't exist. You never have had an accident where all the passengers were vaporized. That's never happened. All their luggage and everything else vaporized. Even the fuselages vaporized. That's never happened.
That's right.
Nor having the ground not be scorched when you have to be that close to the ground in order to make a 10-foot hole. So all this clearly leads to that something else occurred. Who was behind it? Who had access? Who would have had that power? We can only speculate, but I'm not interested in speculation. I'm only interested in what we can prove at this point. The truth will come out in time. We're out of time, Susan. I want to thank you for taking this hour and sharing your insights with us. And Susan is the author of Extreme Prejudice, The Terrifying Story of the Patriot Act and the Cover-Ups of 9/11 in Iraq, and a former U.S. Intelligence asset. Thanks a lot, Susan.
Thank you very much, Gary.
Susan Lindauer, Lindau. I'm Gary Nall. I want to thank you for taking the time to listen to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Have a nice day.